Welcome to episode 59 of Mancy, a podcast about magic and the fucked up shit people did with it. In each set of episodes, we cover a different Mancy or method of magic. I'm RJ Walker. I'm a spoken word poet and writer. With me is my co-host, Elle.
I'm Elle Alder, and I know just as much about the supernatural as I do about interior design.
That's a Beetlejuice.
No, you joke. Ruined it. I was going to offer readings if people could guess where it came from.
Oh, too many people would guess.
No, it would be so great. RJ ruined it.
I ruined it. I ruined it. Your workload is heavy enough.
Rude.
We literally had to skip a week.
Rude.
So, I don't want to hear it. Anyway.
Listen, my workload is back under control. Thank you very much. I have 2 days left of Etsy readings, and then I'm in the clear. I don't have a day in the store this week. I have, a couple of days open for, phone readings. It's not crazy. I'm just saying.
Uh-huh.
Get readings for me, please.
In the last episode, we began our coverage of charms. We looked into the lucky rabbit's foot, the hand of glory, horseshoes, barn stars, and hex signs. We also discussed some of the lucky charms we have, just in general. And we did a bit of charm casting with Elle's lucky charms.
Yeah.
In part two, we got a guest reading. So this is part two. We got a guest reading from a TikTok charm caster.
Yeah.
Who has a charm set inspired by the Magnus Archives, which is a fiction podcast.
I didn't know that was where it was from. Their reading was great.
Yeah. So let's get started with part two of charms, magic with trinkets. All right, so we left off on barn stars, but I'd like to pick up on another magical charm and a magical symbol in general, the Ankh.
I love Ankhs.
I know you're a fan of the Ankh.
I am a fan of the Ankh.
What do you know about the Ankh?
Ankh is, it looks like a cross with a loop on the top of it. It is from Egyptian magic, and it means long life. And so King Tut, King Tut, what is King Tut's full name?
Tutankhamun.
Tutankhamun, which is the long life of the god Amun. And so his full name is actually includes the term Ankh to wish him a long life, which is ironic considering how young he was when he died.
Yeah.
But yeah, I love the Ankh.
Yeah, I was about to say how'd that work out for him?
Yeah, not good.
The Ankh is a familiar shape. It's all over pop culture. The relics in Crash Bandicoot are Ankhs. Also, the DC superhero Dr. Fate utilizes the Ankh as a symbol of his character, as well as conjuring magical Ankhs as weapons. He creates Ankh-shaped portals, shoots Ankh energy blasts out of them, or just summons giant Ankhs to crush people.
Yeah.
Dr. Fate is actually ridiculous and kind of sad. Because Dr. Fate isn't really a person. He's a helmet containing a spiritual cosmic being named Nabu.
Oh.
Nabu is a lord of order inspired by Mesopotamian deities. Whoever wears the helmet becomes possessed by Nabu, his will overriding theirs. So to don the helmet of Dr. Fate is almost like a death sentence where you're in this sort of waking
because
death.
you give everything over to them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And because Nabu can only act through a mortal agent, that's the only way Dr. Fate can be Dr. Fate.
Wow.
Ankhs are other places in pop culture, but I think Dr. Fate is maybe the most recognizable user when it comes to magic and media with Ankhs.
Yeah. Ankhs are a pretty common. I feel like I definitely believed the Ankhs were someone said that they were a Lutheran cross or some shit like that. Maybe there's a Lutheran cross that's similar to it. So
we'll
people
get there.
Have seen. Oh, okay.
We'll get
oh,
there.
Okay. I'm going ahead. All yeah. right. I'll wait.
But what is the Ankh, and what exactly does it mean, and why?
Please tell us.
As you mentioned, it's a cross with a loop on the top. It's a teardrop loop or an oval loop.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not really a reference to crucifixion. It's not like a cross. It just kind of looks like one, but with a loop instead of a top peg.
So, and Ankhs were pre-Christian. So it was the before the cross.
Yeah.
Just so everyone knows.
It really is a representation of a sacred knot called a tayet.
Okay.
The Ankh is also used in hieroglyphic writing because it's because of its use as a charm or amulet is mostly connected to the tayet. It's also called the knot of Isis.
Mm-hmm.
The tayet kind of looks like the Ankh, but instead of the arms like going straight out, they droop down.
What? Because it's gravity.
It's rope. Because of gravity. Yeah. Tayet is a hieroglyph that means welfare or life.
Mm-hmm.
Tayet amulets came to be buried with the dead in the early New Kingdom of Egypt, which is like 1550 BC. The earliest examples go all the way to the reign of Amenhotep III.
Mm-hmm.
And from then until the very end of the dynastic Egyptian history, like all that ancient Egyptian shit, we kept using the Ankh and the Tayet. Egyptian funerary texts included many passages describing the different types of amulets and include spells to be recited over them. In chapter 156 of the Book of the Dead, a New Kingdom funerary text that we've talked about before on the show calls for a Tayet amulet to be made of red jasper and then placed on the neck of the mummy, saying the power of Isis will be the protection of the deceased person's body.
Mm-hmm.
And that the amulet will drive away whoever would commit a crime against him.
Do you know why that was important to have that protection?
Because people robbed graves, I'm
guessing. Well, but do you know why in particular having the body was, like, keeping that sacred and safe was important?
Because if your body got exhumed, then you didn't get to have an afterlife?
Well, so they believe, like, ancient Egyptian, like, belief is that the bodies, like, the souls would come back into the bodies. And if you didn't have somewhere for your soul to go, you didn't have a body for it to go into, you couldn't be reincarnated. And so, like, Hatshepsut, the queen that was the king of Egypt, her body was taken like 20 years after she died and destroyed for that purpose so that she could never come back. It's like the greatest insult to someone who's mummified. Yeah, so that's why they would have that, to make sure that the body was protected and would stay there until the soul came back for it.
Most of the Ankh amulets and Tayet amulets were made of red jasper or other red materials such as carnelian or even red glass. However, many others were made of green materials, such as, how do you say the word of this rock? Faience? F-A-I-E-N-C-E? Faience?
I have never heard of that, so probably.
Well, it's probably in your rock pile over there.
Probably not.
And the color is represented as, like, the renewal of life. It's green and red. Another type of knot is sometimes called the Isis knot, which is a large knot in, like, a mantle worn by Egyptian women from the late period onward. It's associated with Isis because it often appeared on statues of her in Hellenistic Roman times. But apart from its name, it's not really related to the Tayet. It's just confusing because the Tayet is, like, knot of Isis, and then there's also this Isis knot. So just disambiguation there.
Yep.
The Ankh is also a symbol for life, like the Tayet, and they are believed to have originated from the same place, basically. Like, same belief, but they just kind of branched off a little bit, like pictographic slang. In Egyptian belief, life was a force that circulated throughout the world. Individual living things, including humans, were manifestations of this force and fundamentally tied to it. Life came into existence at the creation of the world, and cyclical events like the rising and setting of the sun were thought as reenactments of the original events of creation that maintained and renewed life in the cosmos. Sustaining life was thus a central function of the deities who governed these natural cycles. Therefore, the Ankh was frequently depicted as being held in the gods' hands, representing their life-giving power. The Egyptians also believed that when they died, their individual lives could be renewed in the same manner as life in general. Like you mentioned, the reincarnation thing.
Mm-hmm.
For this reason, gods were often depicted in tombs giving Ankhs to humans, usually the pharaoh. as the sign represented the power to bestow life. Humans, other than the pharaoh, were rarely shown receiving or holding. Like, these plebeians could not hold the ankh, these working people.
Do you want to know something, like a different, really interesting thing that I learned when I was in Egypt looking at the tombs and stuff?
Yeah.
So most of the, I can't remember the rooms where they have the sarcophagus. I don't know the name of it. But like where, like the burial chamber, most of them, like as you walk down into them, they've all been painted. And there's still paint, like that's from like the original when they built them, because they're underground and it's made out of stone. So there's like a lot of lapis paint, which is crazy and beautiful. Anyway, there's all these just depictions of the night sky, and each of the stars is supposed to represent a servant. So the servants would never get to have their bodies, but they would be depicted as like very important to the pharaoh coming back, because who's going to take care of the pharaoh if not the servants that did it when he was alive? And so that was one of the things that they believed, that they would be reincarnated along with the pharaoh, as long as they were like respected and all of that.
What that shit reminds me of? The corporation being like, you can pay to have a star named after you.
Exactly.
You'll get a special certificate.
Oh my God, that happened in Married at First Sight. That was one of the couple's like 1 month anniversary gifts to
That's
each other.
Fucking stupid. Fucking stupid. Basically, yeah, the pharaoh also holding the ankh is a symbol as they like give life to the nation, mm-hmm. like the gods give life to the world. By extension, the concept of life, the ankh, could signify air or water, just like natural life. In artwork, gods hold up the ankh to the nose of the king, offering him the breath of life. Hand fans were another symbol of like air in Egyptian iconography, and the human servants who normally carried fans behind the king were sometimes replaced in artwork by a personified ankh sign with arms, just like fanning.
Some of the like the hieroglyphs and stuff are pretty wild. You're like, this is what they fucking drew? This is the thing that they did?
In scenes of ritual purification in which water was poured over the king or a desiccated commoner, like the zigzag lines that normally represent water could be replaced by chains of ankhs.
Oh, that would be cool.
Yeah. It's jingly jing. My water don't splishy splashy. It jingles.
I thought you were going to say jingly jings. I was excited for that.
The ankh may have been used decoratively more than any other hieroglyphic sign. Mirrors and floral bouquets were made in its shape. Given that the sign was used in writing, the name of each of these objects like included ankh, you know, so they made them in the shape of an ankh. Which is kind of funny because it's like writing the word mirror, and that was the mirror, was just the word mirror.
Yeah. Yeah.
Some other objects, such as like libation vessels and sistra, were also shaped like the sign. The sign appeared very common in the decoration of architectural forms, such as walls, shrines, and temples. In context of these, the sign often appeared together with the it's an Egyptian word. I think it's jed.
How's it spelled?
D-G-A-D. Jed.
Mm-hmm.
Signs, which are pillar-shaped hieroglyphs. Together, the ankh and the jed signified life, dominion, and stability.
Mm-hmm.
In some decorative, like, temples, all three signs, or the ankh, were positioned above the hieroglyph for a basket which represented the word all. So all life and all power and all stability. Some deities, such as Ptah, P-T-A-H, Ta.
It's Pita. It's like Peter, honestly.
Oh, Pita.
Yeah.
And Osiris could be depicted holding like an ankh scepter that originated, like incorporated the different elements of the ankh.
Ptah is the god of night, so he is the opposite.
Oh.
Yeah, he's evil.
He's like, oh my God.
He's the Cain to the Abel. In Egyptian stories.
It's like Khonshu.
Mm-hmm.
Ah. Amulets made in the shape of hieroglyphic signs were meant to impart to the wearer qualities that represented by the sign. Like you wear an ankh to be like, you know, It's like wearing a shirt that says beast mode.
Well, it's like a blessing. It's like the gods, because the gods are the one that are depicted giving like that gift to the pharaoh. So it's basically like, even though you don't get it from the god, it's like the gods have gifted me with eternal life because I'm fucking special. Mm. Like, it's a blessing from it, which is pretty great.
Egyptians wore amulets in daily life as well as, you know, placing them in tombs to ensure the well-being of the deceased in the afterlife. Ankh-shaped amulets first appeared in the Old Kingdom, like 2700 BC, and continued to be used into the late millennium BC. Yet, they were rare despite their importance as a symbol. Amulets shaped like a composite sign that incorporated the Ankh was like... Man, I wrote this really fast because I thought we were going to record.
Yeah. Wait, what were you doing when you were writing this, RJ?
I was watching TV.
Were you sitting in the emergency room with me and my dad? And so maybe that's why there's some mistakes and this is a little rushed and this is, you're going to get to what you fucking get today.
See, I wasn't going to say that. I was going to lie and say I was watching TV. But you said it.
Yeah, so. That's exactly why there's probably some fuck-ups in here. Because we were at the emergency room and he was sitting in the waiting room while my mom was in the room with my dad and I. So that's what we're doing.
Anyway, amulets shaped like the Ankh and the Djed were like very widespread. It's like a protective amulet. Ankh signs in two-dimensional art are typically painted blue or black. The earliest Ankh amulets were often made of gold or electrum, which is like a gold-silver alloy. There were also like ceramic depictions, and on ceramic depictions, they were blue or green. The most common material for Ankh amulets in later times, perhaps because the color represent like the gold represented like regeneration and growth. In modern day, though, Ankhs are associated with mysticism and vampires.
Yeah,
and by
I didn't
proxy,
know that.
Goth culture. Things that are associated with ancient religions tend to be utilized as, like, countercultural elements.
Yeah.
However, the Ankh did become a Christian symbol during the Christianization of Egypt. This was called the Crux Ansata, or handheld cross. According to Socrates of Constantinople, when Christians were dismantling Alexandria's greatest temple in Serapeum, in 391 AD, they noticed cross-like signs inscribed on the stone blocks. Pagans who were present said the sign meant life to come, an indication that the sign Socrates of Constantinople was like, oh, life to come? That's what our cross means.
Must be like, the same thing.
Must be the same thing. Of course, they were referring to the Ankh, right?
Yeah.
The Christians ended up claiming the sign as their own, indicating that they could easily regard the Ankh as the Crux Ansata.
Mm.
It's like a cross that specifically means life to come. And it has a handle. That's what the little loop is. It's
so
a
you
handle,
could hold
the
it.
The handheld cross. Yeah.
Yeah, fuck that. It was Egyptian first, motherfuckers.
The first use of it is actually in the Gospel of Judas, a non-canonical Gnostic text. I've talked about Gnosticism before, but I want to reiterate that Gnosticism can sometimes be appropriated and cherry-picked by anti-Semites.
What?
So heads up before you go digging into Gnosticism. Anyway, the Gospel of Judas is one of my favorite apocryphal gospels, actually.
Okay.
The Gospel of Judas is another one of those, like, Gnostic things that attempts to resolve some of the, like, plot holes in the Bible, particularly the betrayal of Judas. There isn't really any motivation for Judas to betray Jesus in the Bible. Like, he gets 30 pieces of silver, but Judas is never described as greedy or in need of money, or nobody approaches Judas and convinces him. No, that never happens. He just kind of betrays Jesus out of nowhere and gets 30 pieces of silver. The Gospel of Judas asserts that Jesus confided in Judas his purpose as an atoning savior and that he had to die to forgive the sins of humanity. So Judas didn't betray Jesus. He was simply following the plan Jesus had given him to turn him in. Jesus had been sent to die in atonement. So yeah, Judas, you know, like, hey, go turn me in as a criminal so that I can die for the sins of humanity. But why did it have the Crux Ansata in it? Well, the only surviving copy is in the Coptic language. the Coptic Christians, to be reductive, are the Christianized Egyptians from the 3rd and 4th century CE. They adopted the Ankh as the Coptic cross, a symbol of their form of Christianity.
I did not. So I first found out about Coptic Christians when I was in Egypt, because we like visited the churches in like Coptic Egypt. We went there and I didn't know. And the more I'm like diving into Blavatsky, that's really where she came from. Like that was like kind of her startup was like in Coptic Christianity, like Coptic magician, Coptic magic. That's what she studied first. And I'm like, I think I have to know. But I'm but I have a like a almost like repulsion to it because of the Christian part of it, you know? I'm like, I don't want to.
Yeah. And it should be noted that the Crux Ansata / Coptic cross, instead of a teardrop or oval shaped loop at the top, it's a perfect circle.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if a perfect circle sounds like a little much. It's a circle, not an oval.
it's always perfect. Every time they do it, they just make sure it's a perfect
circle. So anyway, that's the knot. Or the Ankh, which is a knot, or the knot of Isis, or the key of life, or like both, like whatever.
Whatever.
But on to the next. See, I want to talk about Ankhs because I knew you'd be really into it.
I'm very into Ankhs.
But the real plan here is to talk about every charm in Lucky Charms.
I know. Cereal. I was wondering, like, if we're going to spend this much time talking about every single thing, and I was like, no. Everybody knows what a blue moon is. Nobody knows what Ankhs are, though.
Yeah. So, and Lucky Charms, to be fair, I think at one point included Ankhs or at least keys. And the Ankh is technically a key. So,
yeah.
So what about the four-leafed clover? Hearts,
what about
stars,
it?
And horseshoes,
clovers
and blue moons, pots of gold, the rainbows, and the red balloons.
Do you have to say all every time?
Every time. Yeah.
Okay.
In fact, I'm going to try and cover all of the Lucky Charms cereal shapes and their symbolisms.
Let's go.
We've already, we done stars. We've done horseshoes. We've done...
We did not do hearts.
No, we're going to do hearts.
We're going to do hearts.
Yeah, hearts are here.
Let's go.
It's
going to
blow your fucking
Let's
mind.
Let's go.
All right.
We have 45 minutes.
Yeah, all right. So, clovers. Well, starters, four-leafed clovers are rare. Clovers commonly have three leaves, and a four-leafed one is a bit of a mutant. Like all things that are rare, we tend to associate them with magic or luck. A diamond in the rough, or a fated encounter with something unusual. In examining 7 million clovers, like in a study, to determine just how rare four-leaf clovers are, only 1 in 5,000 had four leaves. So you have a 1 in 5,000 chance of finding a four-leaf clover.
Wow.
In a patch.
I don't think I've ever found one.
This is certainly rare. I found one once, and that's because my aunt had a big clover patch in her backyard, and I would always go look for them. We don't really have an exact date for when or even how the superstition began. The earliest mention of the four-leafed or purple grass is like Old English, so four is spelled F-O-W-E-R. So the first mention of that is 1640. And it simply says that it was kept in gardens because it was good for the purples in children and others. And when I say purples, I mean like bruises or skin discolorations.
Oh, really?
Yeah. A description from 1869, it was like a text about plants, said that four-leaf clovers were gathered at nighttime during the full moon by a sorceress who... would mix it with verbena and other ingredients while young girls in search of a token of perfect happiness made a quest for the plant every day.
Okay.
The first reference to luck specifically might be from an 11-year-old girl who wrote in an 1877 letter to St. Nicholas Magazine, Santa Claus's OG magazine. Did the fairies ever whisper in your ear that the four-leaf clover brings good luck to the findo?
Oh,
and
cute.
I don't know. It doesn't say what Santa said. No, that's pagan.
Yeah, right. Okay.
Anyway, rare as they might be, though, researchers at the University of Georgia have isolated the genes that result in four-leaf clovers.
Yeah, you can just buy them.
So technically, we could just like GMO up some lucky clovers using science.
I'm pretty sure that I can get a pack of four-leaf clover seeds.
So if it's a GMO four-leaf clover, is it truly rare or magical?
No. That's the thing, everybody. All the bullshit that we've, like, taken and, like, mass-produced, it's not as magical.
If you destroy the rareness, which is what made it magical, is
you can't just,
magical?
Like, reproduce magic and expect it to work like that, you know? You know?
Now we're talking about hearts.
Hearts?
I had no idea how...
I know, RJ's been like, you're going to be so fucked up. You're going to be so fucked up about this.
Blew my mind.
Okay, I'm ready.
So the heart shape, like, why is it so wildly inaccurate to the true anatomy of a heart? Why is this the symbol representing
the heart?
I've heard
it's two hearts together.
No.
Okay.
No, it's not. Even then, what the fuck is,
I know,
is that? That's just,
yeah,
like a Cronenberg mass when you, yeah, smash two hearts together. Surely people knew what a heart looked like. Like, they were hunting animals and,
yeah,
dissecting them and also, like, killing other people. And they know what organs look like. Like, but here's why. Heart-shaped peepaw leaves were used in artistic depictions in the Indus Valley civilization. A heart pendant originating from there has been discovered and is now exhibited in the Delhi National Museum. Silver coins from the Cyrene of the 5th and 6th century BC bear a similar design, sometimes accompanied by a silphium plant.
Ooh.
No, silphium. S-I-L-P-H-I-U-M. Silphium plant, that's what it's called. And is understood to represent its seed or fruit, because that is what the seed or fruit of the silphium plant look like, is that heart shape in the 5th and 6th century BC. The heart shape was used to represent the heart-shaped fruit and seeds of the plant, and the plant was used as a contraceptive.
Oh, okay.
The heart shape represents love and emotion.
But because please don't get me pregnant.
Because it was the leaves of a contraceptive plant. It was like, we're going to fuck. If I give you this heart shape, it means we're fucking.
We're fucking tonight. Take it, like, eat it.
How
and then
did
we're
I miss
go.
This in the sex magic episode? Holy
oh,
shit.
Oh, that's incredible. I love that.
Since ancient times in Japan, the heart symbol has been called Inome, meaning the eye of a wild boar, and it has the meaning of warding off evil spirits. So there are, aww, other places that this shape is found. The decorations used to, like, decorate Shinto shrines, Buddhist temples, castles, and weapons. The oldest example of this pattern is seen in some of the Japanese, like, suba or sword guard, the style called Torangata suba. And those were, like, attached to swords of the 6th to 7th centuries. And part of the suba was hollowed out in the shape of a heart symbol. The eye of the wild boar.
Terrifying.
The heart shape, being a metaphor for the actual heart, though, is something from the Middle Ages. The first known depiction of the heart as a symbol of romantic love dates to the 1250s. It occurs in a miniature decorating of, like, a capital S in the menu. You know how, like, they write the big fancy first letter? Mm-hmm. That's where it was found.
Oh.
In a capital S of a French Roman manuscript. In the miniature, a kneeling lover, or more precisely an allegory for the lover's sweet gaze, offers his heart to a damsel. The heart here resembles kind of more like a pine cone held upside down. So it's the heart symbol, was holding it upside down. In accordance with medieval anatomical descriptions, however, in this miniature, it would suggest the heart shape is only a result of a lover's finger superimposed on the object. So it kind of looks like a heart shape, but it's because drawing fucking sucked in the Middle Ages.
Yes.
So can we debunk that? It's kind of like, well, I don't know. Moreover, the French title of the manuscript that features this, like, miniature drawing translates to Novel of the Pear in English. Thus, the heart-shaped object could very much be a pear.
A pear,
like,
yeah.
We don't know. These fucking middle-aged people didn't know how to fucking draw. Have you seen their drawings of, like, things they haven't seen, like hippopotamus?
Oh my god.
Medieval drawings of hippopotamuses are ridiculous. Because they have no idea how to fucking draw or what they fucking look like. It's just somebody who went to Egypt, like, describing what a hippopotamus looked like. Did you find a picture?
I'm looking right now.
Okay. Opinions, therefore, differ as to whether or not.
I was laughing, imagining you being one of those people. Like, I've been, as you've been doing this episode, I'm reflecting on how, like, you don't know the Egyptian words, but you perfectly can pronounce the Japanese words. And so I was just thinking about, like, you being, like, a middle-evil
I am not
person,
perfectly pronouncing these medieval Japanese words. I'm going to be honest.
But, yeah, you do a much better job with, like, the cadence and shit than, like, I would, for sure. And I was thinking about you being one of these medieval artists that, like, someone went to Egypt, or you went to Egypt and you're just like, that. Listen, it's this thing. I don't know how to pronounce, like, and so I was chuckling.
Anyway, it's a fat dragon that's underwater with a big old face.
Medieval hippo drawing. Yeah, it's got to be that on this one. What the fuck is this, though? What is that? It is a tusked fish with claws, with like back claws, like curly Q tail, and like a sea cucumber snout.
Yeah, like what the fuck is even that?
It's the first one. It's the first one when I Googled it. The rest of them, I mean, it looks like they look like they're very slender and they have like these huge teeth and look very vicious when it's like the most dangerous thing about a hippo is that it's very slow but strong, really. Yeah, these are wild looking.
Yeah.
Okay.
But anyway, he was probably trying to draw a pear. It kind of looked like a heart shape. Although that interpretation is kind of dubious that the pear is representing his heart. Opinions therefore differ over this being the first depiction of the heart symbol as romantic love. The shape is also sometimes used in depictions of the fig leaves that cover up the nudity of Adam and Eve. So, mm-hmm. like, fig leaves are heart-shaped, Adam and Eve, you know? So
fucked.
There we kind of get that. Various hypotheses attempt to connect the heart shape as it evolved into the late Middle Ages with instances of the geometric shape in antiquity, such as the proposed like 60s onwards. So these are fairly modern theories. They remain very speculative as there's no real continuity between supposed ancient predecessors and the late medieval tradition. Specific suggestions include the syphilim plant thing, which I think is the deal, or the silphium plant, the contraceptive. I think that makes a lot of fucking sense.
Yeah.
The stylized depictions of features on the female body. So like boob, butt,
well, there's like, yeah, like
pubic mound or spread vulva. They think that's where people are getting the idea of this shape.
Okay. Okay.
But I like the contraceptive theory. I think that's the
best
one.
That's the best one. That makes sense.
I also like the idea of wearing your birth control on your sleeve.
Yeah, just letting everybody know. Imagine if that was a thing and it was like, I have an IUD. And then we went on dates, people already knew like what the situation was. It's too much. Too much.
Then, of course, there is the sacred heart. You may know it from such things as tattoos. It is usually a Catholic symbol, and the Sacred Heart is an abbreviation. And actually, the name is the Most Sacred Heart of Jesus, and is not just a symbol. It's like an entire ritual, one of the Catholic devotions. The Sacred Heart of Jesus represents God's boundless and overflowing love for mankind and Christ's willingness to sacrifice everything for mankind. The popularization of this devotion in its modern form is derived from a Roman Catholic nun in France, Mary Margaret Alacoque, A-L-A-C-O-Q-U-E, who said she learned the devotion, little burp there, yeah. Who said she learned the devotion from Jesus.
Do you want
Jesus
to clap
himself.
So you know to
nope,
edit that?
Nope. We don't have time. We're going to keep rolling.
We have like 15 minutes right now. So
anyway, Mary Alacoque said she learned the Sacred Heart devotion from Jesus himself.
Oh, okay.
During a series of like apparitions that appeared to her. So like Jesus, like ghost Jesus comes and he's like, ooh, I have no ritual for you.
I mean, that's basically how my guides talk to me, but it's not Jesus.
In like
it's Charlie.
1637, which like, I mean, this is Joseph Smith's story. It's just with a person who's like, actually this, but Catholicism.
Yeah, right.
So like, yeah, 1673-ish. And later in the 19th century, from the mystical revelations of another Catholic nun in Portugal, And she was called and this is other rituals called Mary of the Divine Heart, a religious sister of the Congregation of the Good Shepherd. And she requested in the name of Christ that Pope Leo the 13th consecrate the entire world to the Sacred Heart of Jesus. Predecessors to the modern devotion arose unmistakably in the Middle Ages in various facets of Catholic mysticism, particularly with Gertrude the Great, who was a German nun raised to sainthood. Maybe we'll talk about Gertrude the Great in another episode if we do like Catholic magic. Maybe we'll invite Jesse Parent for Catholic magic.
Yeah, he's Episcopalian.
No, he's Catholic, but he goes to the Episcopalian church.
I mean, Episcopalian church is much better, but that's, yeah.
Some Catholics enthrone the Sacred Heart in their homes, which is like placing an image of the Sacred Heart of Jesus in a place of honor in the home, like an altar or like in a framed picture. After a time of like prayerful preparation, many families will also place an image of the Immaculate Heart of Mary, mm-hmm. which is like in tandem with the Sacred Heart, like they go together in some areas. There lay apostolates dedicated to promoting and witnessing enthronements. I like the word enthronement.
Enthronement.
Enthroning the Sacred Heart in a home should not be confused with the practice of having a priest or Christian minister bless a home, which is like customarily done when a family occupies a new home mm-hmm. and is offered by a minister. The presence of a priest is not required for enthronement.
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned the Immaculate Heart of Mary, the counterpart of the Sacred Heart of Jesus. The Immaculate Heart of Mary! Is a Roman – they're so dramatic with these – is a Roman Catholic devotional name used to refer to the Catholic view of the interior life of Mary, Mother of Jesus, her joys and sorrows, her virtues, and her hidden perfections. And above all, her virginal love for God the Father, her maternal love for Jesus Christ, and her motherly
– Does she get to have sexual love? Because if not, like that, I mean, that's fucked. Like, that's like primary issue that I have. You can be virginal, motherly, wifely.
You can't,
but not sexually.
You can't be virginal and sexually at the same time.
I mean, opposite things can exist. She can have virginal love towards the God and also have her own sexuality. I'm sorry. It's just not the thing.
Mary never, ever gets any sexual anything because of the divine virgin thing.
Okay, but probably that's not real. So. Probably actual Mary
still probably, fucking Joseph. Like, let's be real.
Like, right. Like, not ever. He was like, oh, no, definitely I'm fine with God impregnating you. I don't need to make sure people know that you belong to me, as is often the case with consummating marriages in Christianity. But it's fine. It's fine.
Joseph, I didn't marry you so we could bear the Son of God. I married you because
so we could fuck.
Because you're a carpenter. And I want that wood.
I want that wood. No, blasphemy. That's it. We're going to go to hell now for that
one. Oh, yeah, absolutely. I'm sorry. I apologize to Catholics everywhere. traditionally, the Immaculate Heart is depicted pierced with seven wounds or swords in homage to the seven sorrows of Mary. Mm-hmm. And usually there's red or white roses like wrapped around the heart versus mm-hmm. the Sacred Heart, which has like a flame coming out
flame.
The top, like a potion with like crown of thorns around it.
Yeah.
Last thing I want to talk about in this episode is balloons.
Balloons!
Hearts, stars, horseshoes, clovers and balloons, pots of gold and rainbows, and the red balloons. Are balloons lucky, Elle? Are balloons lucky?
No.
No.
I don't know why. I just decided no.
No?
No.
They're actually kind of, yeah, they're kind of lucky. Well, mostly because their technological predecessor, the Sky Lantern, is lucky.
Oh, okay.
You might not think of them as balloons, but they're hot air balloons. That's how they work.
Yeah, that's the thing.
The annual Sky Lantern Festival.
We should go to that this year. It's in August.
I'm talking about the one in Japan, the actual one. It was like the Paper Balloon Festival. Is in Semboku, Akita, on February 10th each year.
Oh, okay.
Hundreds of very large lanterns, known as Kamifusen, are flown for good luck in the coming year.
We should go do that.
Let's wait till the end before we make these decisions. Lanterns are made of washi, traditional Japanese, like the thin paper. The festival has mythical origins, because, like, of course, why do you fly lanterns? And was suspended during World War II and then revived in 1974.
Hmm.
So these, like, sky lanterns were, like, you know, like, we're going to do this magical thing for the gods, you know, send little messages to the gods. Their invention, however, is traditionally attributed to the Chinese sage and military strategist Zheng Liang, Z-H-U-G-E. So, Zhuge Liang, L-I-A-N-G, whose reverent term of address was Kongming. He is said to have used, like, a message written on a sky lantern to summon help on an occasion when he was surrounded by enemy troops. For this reason, they are still known in China as Kongming lanterns. Another suggested origin is that the name actually comes from the lantern's resemblance to the hat Kongmin is traditionally shown wearing.
Oh, okay. So
he made a little balloon out of his hat to, like, call for help. It's like, don't worry, troops. I've got this. I wore my special hat.
Okay.
Later, though, helium and latex would replace the fire lanterns, as the lanterns tended to, you know, light shit on fire when
what?
They landed. And then, we'd have all the latex balloons. We'd do that instead. We'd do balloon releases. And then the fire lanterns, we'd go back to those, as the latex balloons tended to also be a different kind of ecological nightmare. I am, of course, referring to the extremely cursed Balloon Fest of 1986. United Way, a nonprofit fundraising group, was seeking to break the world record for the most balloons released. And they got that world record. But it came at a heavy, heavy price.
Uh-oh.
For what they thought would be a harmless publicity stunt. Much suffering occurred.
Okay.
A company called Balloon Art by Treb coordinated the event. A cage the size of a city block was erected in the city of Cleveland, and children sold balloons for 50 cents $1 for two balloons to help fundraise for the nonprofit. The cage could hold 2 million balloons, but it ended up containing 1.4 million balloons. More than enough for the world record, which was previously held by Disneyland. Inside the cage, 2,500 students spent hours and hours filling up the balloons with just trucks that were going back and forth with helium tanks. It's so much fucking helium. And then, on Saturday, September 27th, 1984, all 1.4 million balloons were released. And the result was absolute chaos.
Okay.
A rainstorm was approaching, so they decided to release early to avoid the rain. But here's the thing about storms. They alter the air pressure and are often preceded by heavy wind. And the balloons just fucking went everywhere. They were blown back down to the ground level and blinded everybody. There were car accidents. They got caught in waterways. They got caught on trees and infrastructure. People got lost in crowds because the fucking balloons attacked them because the air pressure pushed them all back down to the ground.
They're still finding these balloons. They have to be still finding them.
They are. Balloons were found washed ashore on the Canadian side of Lake Erie. Like from Ohio all the way over to fucking Canada, they found these United Way balloons. Traffic
Jesus.
Collisions were reported. Drivers, swerved to avoid, slow motion blizzards of multicolored orbs. And they took their eyes off the road to gawk at, the hellish beast rising from the skyscrapers. Balloons landed on a pasture in Medina County, Ohio. And it spooked Louise Nowalski's Arabian horses, which allegedly suffered permanent injuries as a result. And she sued United Way of Cleveland for $100,000 in damages and then settled on undisclosed terms. That is not the worst thing. Two fishermen, Raymond Broderick and Bernard Sulzer, had gone out on that day and they were reported missing by their families out on the water. Rescuers spotted their 16-foot boat anchored west of Edgewater Park, Breakwall. The Coast Guard search and rescue helicopter crew had difficulties reaching the area because of the asteroid field of balloons.
Oh, no.
A search and rescue boat tried to spot the fishermen floating in the lake, but guard officials said balloons in the water made it impossible to see whether anyone was in the lake or not. On September 29th, the Coast Guard suspended its search. The fishermen's bodies were washed ashore. The wife of one of the fishermen sued United Way of Cleveland and the company for that organized the balloon release for $3.2 million and settled on undisclosed terms. Yeah.
Yikes.
Yeah. So yeah, the Lantern Festival is all about like celebrating luck and giving good messages up into the air and blah, blah, blah. But the balloons and lantern releases, maybe we should just like never do that.
Yeah.
Like Guinness Book of World Records acknowledged that United Way holds the record. They gave them that. But they also said that they would be the last because they would never, ever
do it again.
After it was so, this was the event that was so disastrous, Guinness Book of World Records officially refused to acknowledge any record that would have a damaging environmental impact.
Like the ladybugs.
like the guy who released the ladybugs in Central Park.
Yeah. Oh, I was like, do we talk about that? There's a guy who released, I think it was 250,000 ladybugs in Central Park.
Yeah.
Or it was something. It was some, like, absurd
number. We're pretty sure it's a TikTok hoax, but, like, somebody tried to sue him for environmental terrorism, and he, like...
And he said that he was under house arrest.
And he, like, cut off his bracelet and fled to Colombia. I think it was a TikTok hoax.
But. Yeah. But, like that guy. Like, if that's what you're going to do, no Guinness Book of World
Records. When we do Entomancy, maybe we'll talk about that.
Yeah.
And with that, it is time for... Anyway, balloons. Maybe good luck... Maybe bad luck.
I don't think good luck.
Yeah, I think cursed.
I think lanterns, good luck. Balloons, bad luck.
I think
bad for the environment.
Well, even the lanterns would like light the wilderness on fire and like burn down like small towns when they have these lantern festivals. I believe there was a fire in Tooele when they had their lantern festival, but I'm not sure. So anyway, cursed, I think. I think certified cursed. And with that, it's time for our guest charm casting reading. I'll just splice in the audio from her reading she did for us on TikTok. I asked at the Worker in Clay on TikTok when I found her charm casting channel. Apparently, their charm casting is based off of the Magnus archives. Here's the reading.
Today we have a very special reading request from RJ Walker of the Mancy podcast, who has asked very specifically, should I get the fuck out of Utah? Ooh, I really like where this is going. This is going to be interesting. So as always, we look at the buried and the vast first, and they are pretty close together, so that suggests an overall sense of cosmic balance and balance in other areas. So the vast brought a friend. We have the extinction, which represents society and other big things that you care about. And so sort of on the larger and abstract and big and scary and daunting end of this question, we have in the balance your loved ones, your values, the things that you're striving for in your life. So for further clarification, let's go to the hunt, which represents goal-oriented behavior. And it's kind of pointing at two things here. It's pointing at the lonely, which represents mental state most of the time, and the flesh, which represents humanity. So even as we're keeping in mind society, loved ones, and values, we have to remember that the goal here is for mental health and self-preservation, honestly. And if we look, it's kind of dovetailing here. So next to the symbol of humanity and self-preservation, we have the slaughter, which is the token for self-empowerment and passion. And next to the lonely representing mental state, we have the end for personal change and conclusion. So that's pretty telling right there. In contrast to all of this, we have the eye really far away from everything else in the picture, which suggests sort of a detached observance, a desire for objectivity and using the facts and information that we have at hand. We also have the stranger face down, and the stranger represents identity. So that could mean that either presently or in the past or maybe even in the future, there is a sense of suffering of identity. Generally, it's pretty difficult for me to tell temporal differences, but I'm getting the sense that maybe it's Utah that's causing the identity suffering. Another key thing to note, we have the desolation not touching anything, which can mean a sense of pent-up energy or frustration at the current situation, or a desire to take some direct action that hasn't quite come to fruition yet. And finally, kind of on the fringes, we have the dark for doubt in the unknown and the web for things that are outside of our control. So maybe these looming presences of things that are not quite within your control, basically. I hope that answers your question. Definitely remember what the hunt said. Thanks.
All right, Elle, what did you think of the worker in clay's reading for me?
I really liked it. I liked it a lot. I feel like one of the things that can be maybe a bit frustrating is when we ask divination like yes or no questions, because then like she didn't really answer it, right? She just was like, this is all the stuff we see. And so that is a thing. And I feel like that is potentially like a little bit of an issue, because between you and I, like, to me, that reading was like, yes, absolutely, get the fuck out of Utah. And to you, you were like, well, my values, my family, all of this stuff, that means I have to stay in Utah.
Not my family.
Well, I mean, our chosen family, like, yeah. Our people, our creative friends, the artists that we, like, live our lives with, that's family,
yeah,
to me.
My entire support network is all here. And starting over career-wise in another place would be difficult.
But see, the thing is when she's talking about the things that like sit in balance, the things that you have against that is literally the projection of your life. It's your potential. It's the things that you can create. And so it's basically like she's saying you're trading comfort for this other thing, or that's really what you're balancing is like, do I want to really see how far I can make it, or do I want to stick with what I've been doing? But do you see how you have a different interpretation of what that means than I do?
Yeah.
And how I see that? I thought it was really good. I really liked it. I do think that divination, a lot of times when it's good, reveals to the person who's asking what they actually want to hear. And so I think that this is an instance where that could be a little true.
And, I mean, I'm, you know, putting a lot of stock into, like, what opportunities exist outside of Utah first before being like, I'm going to move out of Utah.
Well, I mean, I think that there exists here a perception of, like, maybe some holdover of like a belief about what exists in Utah and like how this can be the thing that you want it to be versus like things that actually exist outside of it, because most artist cultures are very like nomadic. Like that is kind of a reason that that artists do what they do or can do is because they're nomadic. There's opportunities everywhere. There are connections everywhere. It just depends on how much you're willing to go after those things to meet your potential.
Well, as nomadic as you say a lot of the arts are, a lot of the grants are specifically for and only for artists based in
certain
areas.
But you don't have
areas.
To do, like, grants to survive. Like, that's the thing. There's so much of this. It doesn't matter. We don't need to have this conversation on the show. I'm just saying that is maybe a thing that could be an issue, that the interpretation is, like, not necessarily super clear.
Yeah.
I liked it. What did you think?
I liked the different charms, like the stranger being like a
little baby. So cute, you know, face down baby.
And like the Magnus Archives theme is kind of fun, like mm-hmm. having this sort of like pop theme like associated with it.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of fun. Yeah.
Do you feel like it informed your choice?
Not really.
Oh, okay.
I don't let divination inform my choices in general.
Well, I think maybe if you put a little bit of stock into them, you could get some clarity about what you actually want, and that might be something that you could benefit from.
What I want is to keep making cool stuff and have stability.
Right. Those are things that can happen a lot of places.
That can happen here and it can happen elsewhere, but finding those opportunities...
Well, why don't you graduate from college? go ahead and do that, and then we'll figure it out.
Well, I mean,
that's a good step.
That's why I go to college, right? So it opens up opportunities.
Yes, but it also, if you, go to college, then it also opens up opportunities, scholastically. And so those are not areas that you only have to, receive grants or have this, really advanced network of artists that you already work with.
Yeah, whatever.
It's fine, I'm right, it's fine. It's okay, no worries. The stranger is a baby. That's the thoughts.
That was my drink. It's a Red Bull in tea.
It's Red Bull tea with raspberry
something.
Coconut?
I don't know.
Mango? Black tea?
Some bullshit they made at the coffee shop.
It doesn't look like it would be carbonated, but it is when you drink it.
Yeah, it's pretty good. I like caffeinated things.
I like it when people say hi.
Maybe as a bonus episode thing.
Yeah,
later,
we should talk about lore.
The time Aaron Mankey blocked me because I called him out for doing a show at BYU.
So he likes it when people say hi, but not RJ.
not
RJ's not allowed to say hi.
I'm gonna be like, no, don't do that.
Yeah, that's real.
So in the next episode for Charms, part 3,
mm-hmm.
Elle is going to do a charm reading using Lucky Charms cereal.
I'm going to poison myself with the gluten.
They aren't gluten.
I think they are.
No, they aren't gluten. They're oat. They're Cheerios with marshmallows.
Well, Cheerios are not necessarily oats. Hold on.
Yeah. I'm quite positive that Lucky Charms are made with oats. Not
wheat. Oh yeah. What? This entire time.
You could have been
eating
Lucky Charms.
This entire time. Gluten-free oats and marshmallows for a sweet breakfast option. I legitimately didn't know that. I have not bought them. Well, I mean, I don't really eat cereal that has marshmallows in it anymore.
But
I could. I could have been.
They could be magic. We've done hearts and stars and horseshoes. Clovers. We haven't done blue moons. We haven't done pots of gold. We haven't done rainbows.
Those are the last three.
And we did red balloons. So yeah, we got the last three. And moon magic is an entire thing.
Yeah,
so we're talking about what a blue moon is specifically.
Moon magic would be we could just start that series. We could just be this is only the moon series of studies of moon magic from different cultures.
Yeah.
And that would be more than enough.
Ludomancy is its own huge thing and deserves its own series.
Yeah.
The rainbows, lots of shit about rainbows.
They're
pots
gay.
Of gold. Yeah, they're that, but also magic. pots of gold.
I mean, I don't know if that's... of course that's a good luck symbol. It's fucking money.
It's just, tons of money that you find. So we're going to talk about the mythology there. The mythology of just, finding tons of money.
Yeah, yeah. Are you going to tell us about finding a pot of gold at the end of a rainbow?
Yeah, and I'm also going to talk about, secret treasure troves. Magical treasure troves that are hidden.
Mm-hmm.
Like the Rhodes Mine, the Dream Mine. If you've been watching Under the Banner of Heaven, you might know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Anyway, hit us up on Patreon and Elle will do a reading for you on the show using whatever divination method we're covering. If you like my writing, you can find books at rjwalkerpoet.com.
Oh, that's me. I'm so sorry. If you wanted to get a reading from someone who can't even pay attention to recording a podcast for very long, you can get one. My Etsy. I'm a fucking wreck. I'm so sorry, you guys. You can find me on my Etsy, which is at Laurels of Lux. You can go to my website, laurelsoflux.com. I do phone readings. I do in-person readings at the Conjuring Tree in Salt Lake City. And I'm available to help you with all sorts of stuff. And I have some, hopefully really good, fun summer plans coming up. So I would love to be doing more readings.
Yeah. Also... Elle is maybe probably going to be taking several months off.
Yeah.
So I'm going to try to keep Mancy going with other guests on the show.
we're gonna just fucking see where life goes. I mean, Crotchy told me today that I was allowed to go have a break. So.
Crotchy is the rip in my pants that I work
only
like a puppet.
In his crotch, in certain Old Navy jeans, and it is lovingly referred to as Crotchy, and he said it was okay. So,
yeah. When I say hit us up on Patreon, you don't have to actually be a paid subscriber to get some of the bonus content.
Yeah.
There's free bonus content on there. You just have to hit the follow button. And then if you want more bonus content, then you can...
Then you can subscribe.
Subscribe. Didn't have my phone
set. Oh, RJ.
The music was provided by Hayden Folker, Miyu, and Scott Buckley.